Well, good morning, everybody. It's great to see you here. And I just want to start by saying how thankful I am for being invited to speak on this topic. It's a subject very dear to my heart, as James just explained. I've spent the last 20 years plus reaching out to women in crisis with an unplanned pregnancy or struggling with painful, confusing emotions after an abortion. And I feel passionate about how we should respond to the unborn human and the woman in whose womb they are lodged. I've also learned in the last 20 years that abortion is a highly sensitive subject. So I want to say at the outset that firstly, I honour that abortion will have been the experience, personal experience for some of you here, or those watching actually. Either you or possibly a family member or a close friend or even in a professional capacity. There is no judgment here. Secondly, some of you will have been pro-life campaigners maybe or very committed to that cause and have devoted many hours and much emotional energy to see the law change to protect the unborn. And I honour your hearts for that too, although it's not been my chosen path. Whoever you are, you may disagree with some of what I'll say, but please, please come and speak to me afterwards if that's the case and just share your views and we can ensure that we understand each other. It may be that you've misunderstood something I've said. Or pop a question into Slido. We may continue to disagree, of course, and that's fine. Christians have always disagreed. And just finally, by way of introduction, I want to say that the views I will be sharing today are my own. I am not speaking as a representative of any organisation, although I do belong to some. So let's get going. My goal with this lecture is to ask three questions about the unborn human. What does our culture say about the unborn? What does the Bible say? And how then should we respond as Christians? So first, the difficult bit. What does our Bible say? What does our culture say about the unborn? So in our society, it's widely accepted as a right, and it's enshrined by law, this right, that women should have free and safe access to termination of a pregnancy. So up to 24 weeks for so-called social reasons, that 24 weeks gestation of a pregnancy, that's about just under 6 months, and up to full term for serious fetal abnormality or if there's a risk to the mother's life. And this law prioritises the rights of the woman over the unborn. So what are the numbers? What's the size of the problem? So the latest full year statistics we have are for 2021, and there were 228,000 terminations in the UK. That includes Northern Ireland and Scotland. This is the highest figure ever recorded for the UK. And it represents a steep rise, as you can see from that graph there. It's possibly affected by the pandemic, but there was a started pre-pandemic in 2016. Last month, the half-year stats were released for 2022, last year, and these already show a 17% increase compared to the same period in 2021. So nobody really knows the reason for this. But whatever the reasons are, this is still a huge issue in our society. What does that mean in more kind of human or practical terms? Basically, the statistic is that one in three women will have an abortion by the time they're 45. And one in five conceptions in the UK ends in termination. So it's been said that the most dangerous place for a child in the UK today is actually in their mother's womb. These figures all mean that we know personally someone affected by this. We will not know that fact about them necessarily. Because despite its wide social acceptance, women still find it shameful to speak about their abortions. And that's especially true for women in the church. So let's take a brief look back to the history. How did we get to this point? So the Abortion Act was passed in 1967, and it legalized abortion under certain circumstances. It was presented as a sad necessity for rare cases, most doctors, including some Christian doctors, embrace legalization as a better alternative to death by backstreet abortion. But although it began as a way of reducing harm to women, with the advent of the feminist movement in the 1970s, the narrative changed and it became every woman's right to choose. So women looked across and saw the gender inequalities and saw this new ability to get rid of an unwanted pregnancy as a liberation. The narrative became my body, my choice. And abortion figures began to steadily climb, as you can see from the stats on the screen. So to bring us a bit more up to date, in 1990, a revision of the Human Fertilization and Embryology Act reduced the upper time limit, which had previously been at 28 weeks. It came down to 24 weeks, but it extended to 40 weeks, i.e. full term of a pregnancy, the right to terminate for serious fetal abnormality or if the mother's life was at risk. This is not actually a well-known fact. Subsequently, since that, in 1999, the trend is now towards complete decriminalisation of abortion, as seen with the recent changes in the law in Northern Ireland in October 2019. We have yet to see decriminalisation of abortion in here, in the UK, in England and Wales. But in March 2022, a temporary provision that was made during the pandemic became permanent, so that women can now secure an abortion, a medical termination, that's an induced miscarriage using pills rather than surgical procedures. They can now secure a medical termination up to 10 weeks of a pregnancy via a simple telephone call to the abortion clinic. The medication is sent by post and she has the abortion at home. No ultrasound scan to establish gestation, no medical consultation. And now over half of all medical terminations are now via the pills by post scheme. So despite stories of medical disasters and actually also coercive abortions emerging, these recent changes in the law are actually celebrated as further steps on the road to liberalisation. And events like this one from The Guardian, this came out in June this year. So this is where a woman obtained abortion pills via the telephone call by claiming that she was only 7 weeks pregnant when she was actually 32 weeks pregnant. Events like these are merely turned into arguments for the necessity of criminalisation. So in summary, I think it's fair to say that our culture now appears to believe the unborn human, if not wanted by the mother, is disposable. So how does this dramatic shift in carton values affect the women who choose abortion? Abortion on demand was billed as freedom for women, but is it? An unwanted pregnancy can be removed quickly, efficiently, and safely, in quotes, physically safely. But is this the best solution? The child is lost, but how does it affect those who are involved? Let's begin with looking at the impact personally for those who've had abortions. My conviction, having worked with scores of women and some men, so I've seen couples, I've even seen men individually for post-abortion counselling, to help them process that abortion experience, my conviction is that it's clearly damaging for some, both psychologically and emotionally. Whilst every client's story is unique, of course, I've noticed various themes emerge. There's a kind of toxic mix and painful mix of guilt and shame, anger at being coerced by boyfriend, parents, or others, but also anger at themselves. There's also, of course, grief at the loss of the child, but at the same time, feeling they don't deserve to feel sad. We call it an unemancipated grief. Plus, I think they also have what you could describe as a moral injury or trauma. That is, they've crossed a line internally, which they didn't know they had. And this causes profound internal confusion and can really undermine their self-confidence and their trust in their decision-making. And it deeply damages self-respect, as you can imagine. So polarized Opinions on abortion make it difficult to find trustworthy academic research evidence either way. But some studies have emerged from neutral research, as you could call them, that women who have terminations are at greater risk of experiencing adverse mental health outcomes. Symptoms can range from depression and anxiety, which obviously are very common, but to more severe PTSD-type effects, with panic attacks, flashbacks, intrusive thoughts, and an increased risk of substance abuse. I've seen all of these in the counselling room with my clients, and these women and men require professional help to heal. It's not uncommon for post-abortion clients to seek help up to years after the event. I've worked with several clients whose abortions had taken place decades earlier. It's tragic that they've carried that unshared burden for so long. And we will actually consider one client's story like this later and how to help such women. But there's much, much more information both on the history and the impact on women personally, with examples from my experience in your handouts. I just couldn't put it all in today, but it's all there and it's important to read, and I hope you get a chance to have a look at it. I've touched on the personal impact of abortion for women first here, partly to honour those who recognise the experience personally, but also to really help us begin to understand that abortion does not only hurt the unborn child, it hurts the mother too, and many others. So what about the wider impact for women? Is it liberation? Has abortion delivered on its promise of freedom? No. In my opinion, women have been sold a lie. My conclusion from counselling hundreds of women and couples is that a liberal abortion policy, if anything, has benefited men more than women. Feminism has shot itself in the foot, as they say. And I say that as someone who's actually strongly pro-woman. Because abortion is legal and easy, pregnant women are unprotected from the pressure to terminate from men who don't want the responsibility of fatherhood. Even the partner who says, "I'll support you whatever you choose," and I have heard this many, many times, is not actually being truly supportive. Because all his partner hears is, "It's your responsibility, you choose. You have the burden of the choice." Legally, that is, of course, the case. The man doesn't have a say. But what an unsure pregnant woman really wants to hear is that her partner will stand by her if she continues the pregnancy. So abortion has not only led women to feeling pressurized to choose between partner and baby, but in many cases, I feel, has robbed the men of the opportunity to step up and take responsibility. So again, more information and examples in your handouts. But it shouldn't surprise us that our society's choice to make our unborn children disposable and to make an idol out of our freedom for women has not delivered the freedom that it promised. And that's because idols never do. So what's been the impact of this changed attitude towards the women for all pregnant women? What has it done to the experience of pregnancy for all of us? I think we've produced what can only be called a double think. There are parallel but mutually conflicting narratives which people appear to be genuinely blind to, even though I find it jaw-dropping that they're blind to it. So with a wanted pregnancy, the language from day one is all about your baby and your pregnancy. This is from the NHS website. And miscarriage is acknowledged as a terrible loss. So here, after a miscarriage, it can be upsetting. You can try for another baby. And again, I'd like to acknowledge here how painful this is, this experience of miscarriage. And I know it's such a common experience, and it will have been, again, the experience of many of you here. It really hurts. But for an unwanted pregnancy, the language becomes treatment, healthcare, the pregnancy. This says the pregnancy is removed. That's not even correct terminology, is it? These are screenshots from Murray Stopes' website, when Murray Stopes is one of the UK's main abortion providers. Having these parallel narratives is really hard for women who have lost babies by miscarriage. It really devalues and minimises their grief. So these two conflicting narratives collide for women who receive a diagnosis of a fetal abnormality during the pregnancy. The whole purpose of antenatal screening is to give women the option to avoid having a disabled child. So when disability is picked up and some kind of abnormality, they can come under extraordinary pressure, both from the professionals but also others, when fetal abnormality is detected. It then becomes the parents who are having to justify continuing the pregnancy. Everyone else expects them to terminate and to try again. And again, this may have been the experience for people here, and I acknowledge that. I strongly recommend Sarah Williams' book, Perfectly Human, 9 months with Kerrion. Sarah tells the story of her daughter's antenatal diagnosis with a terminal condition that her daughter wouldn't survive with, and her fight to see the pregnancy through and to give birth and not have a termination. It's a wonderful example of how changed attitudes brought one family under pressure, but the wonder of how much better it was to do it God's way. I'd strongly recommend it. It's a good book. There's so much, again, I could say here, but I hope that's enough to give an indication of how much abortion laws have contributed to a change in our culture's thinking about the value of unborn life. It's like by opening the door to viewing the unborn child as disposable, it's distorted all our seeing of pregnancy and the unborn. It's all become warped and skewed. And this gulf between the way Christians see the world and the unborn and the way the world is seeing it just gets bigger and bigger. So sorry, that's really hard. And it's like all the difficult stuff is at the beginning. So let's turn with some relief to asking, what does the Bible have to say? I'm actually going to spend a short time on this because we're going to look at more scripture later on. It's not because it's not central, but basically because I hope a well-informed audience like you are really understand the biblical understanding of the value of the unborn already. But anyway, let's look at the Bible because it's always so encouraging. So we're going to begin with Psalm 139, verses 1 to 18. We haven't got time to read the whole text, I'm afraid. But if you could find it in your Bibles, that would be helpful. So in this psalm, David reflects on his personal intimacy with this God who knows him inside out. So verse 1 to 3, "You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways." He also reflects on God's constant presence, even inescapably at times. So verse 7, "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence?" Answer, nowhere. And David's conclusion, he's satisfied that God's loving covenantal presence is with him at all times and in all places. He cannot move beyond its reach. But then he thinks, hang on a moment, what about my past? Was God always there then? And he looks back as far as he can go, right back into the womb, and discovers God's presence there, even then. So verse 13, "You knit me together in my mother's womb." And verse 16, "All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be." So yes, hallelujah, God was there. And what's more, David realizes that whilst he wasn't even aware of his own existence, God saw him, committed himself to him, and knew what his lifespan would be. How precious, as David says in verse 17. So again, for our purposes, this psalm therefore teaches the continuity of the unborn with the born, both in terms of God's presence with them, but also that there's not a sea change between the unborn and the born. David doesn't say this thing that would become him. He uses the personal pronouns to describe his unborn self. "You created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. It was him then, just as it is him now. There's continuity from his embryonic self right through to his adult self. And God is in covenantal commitment to him from his very beginning in the womb. So let's turn to another passage in the New Testament this time. This is Luke chapter 1, verses 41 to 44. You can fit this on the screen. I'm sorry, I've turned over my page too soon. So Luke chapter 1, when Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, the baby leapt in her womb, and Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit. In a loud voice she exclaimed, "Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the child you will bear. But why am I so favored that the mother of my Lord should come to me? As soon as the sound of your greeting reached my ears, the baby in my womb leapt for joy." So what's going on here? An onlooker would see two women. But Luke describes the scene with four players. The pregnant Elizabeth, a 26-week gestation John the Baptist, a young pregnant girl, Mary, not yet showing, and a tiny Jesus, barely visible to the naked eye. As Mary arrives, Elizabeth exclaims, her unborn son has leapt in the womb at being in the presence of Mary, and therefore the presence of the unborn Jesus, whom Elizabeth astonishingly describes as her Lord, my Lord. It is such a touching scene, and what an encouragement it must have been for Mary. But again, for our purposes, it points out the full personhood of the unborn children in that scenario. They are players in their own right, John the Baptist in his leap for joy, and Jesus by his tiny but significant presence as Lord. And secondly, this text confirms the incredible mystery of the incarnation. The Lord of the universe submits to being knitted together in his mother's womb, made of her stuff, her genes, her flesh, her blood, just like every other human baby before and after him. This alone sanctifies the life of the unborn human and invests that state of being with honor, respect, and wonder. It's just worth adding here that the New Testament writers used one Greek word to describe both the baby in the womb and the baby after birth. In fact, just like us, they use the word brephos. And like us, when they use that word, baby, for both, they imply the child within the womb and the child outside the womb is the same being, with the same worth and value, and due the same protection. But thankfully, unlike us, the Bible doesn't suffer from doublethink. The unborn brephos, or baby, is always a human being, not just if it's wanted. So what can we conclude from this? The Bible clearly teaches, to my mind, that the unborn child is fully human and is accordingly formed in the image of God, and that therefore to knowingly terminate a pregnancy is tantamount to taking a life. But whenever we say something is wrong, we must come up with a better solution than the one the world is offering. So what might a better story look like? Let's turn to our third question. What should a Christian response be? Let's begin by asking, how have Christians responded in the past, in the more recent past, to this issue? Historically, and especially since the Abortion Act of 1967, pro-life activism has focused on campaigning to see abortion law restricted so that innocent unborn lives are no longer destroyed in such distressing numbers as we saw earlier. It's not fair to say that no attempts have been made to support women with the dilemma of unplanned pregnancy, but for most pro-life groups, their main ambition has been to see the law changed, as in fact has just happened in the United States. However, in the UK, we have not seen this vision realized. And abortion numbers here continue to rise, as we saw, and the law has been progressively liberalized. I'm not suggesting for a minute that pro-life campaigning should stop. There's definitely a place for it. But is there any other way to make a difference? When I first began working in a Christian pregnancy centre 20 years ago, I thought of myself as saving babies. But actually, as I began to counsel worried pregnant women, I rapidly understood that this is about them too. We must reach out to them. The polarized political debate has often represented the babies and the mother's needs as being an irreconcilable conflict. But actually, I've come to see that the best interests of the mother and the best interests of the baby are not in conflict. And we really need to hold these two together. That's the way forward. Both lives matter. It's a position of faith. I believe this, and I think it's one which the Bible teaches. So let's return to the scriptures again. What does the Bible say about our response to abortion-minded women or those who've had abortions? Well, unfortunately, of course, there's no proof texting. But let's look at how Jesus dealt with this with people. So in the opening chapter of John's Gospel, Jesus is described in this way. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth. John 1:14. I think the way forward is to hold this tension between grace and truth. The truth of what's in the womb, a tiny human being deserving of love and protection, but grace for the woman and the abortion-minded, the post-abortive. Before we explore what that looks like, I want to tell you a story. This is Annette's story, name changed, of course. Annette was so excited. She had finally arrived in London to start her nurse's training. Back home in Uganda, she'd worked so hard for this opportunity. Now, at the age of 18, her dreams were coming true. However, Ugandan village life had not equipped her to handle the city. Naive, alone, and friendless, she was vulnerable to the young man who persuaded her he loved her. And it was not long before she became pregnant. Wrongly convinced that the disgrace would lead to the end of her nurse training, she agreed to a termination. And as the pregnancy was quite advanced, her medical termination meant that she saw and held her 16-week baby boy. Traumatizing enough, we think. But her Christian upbringing had taught her that abortion was wrong. So her heart was broken by the loss of her baby, but so was her self-respect and sense of worth. Annette continued her nurse training, but a continuous pain settled in her chest. She went to church repeatedly asking for forgiveness, but felt there was never enough that she could do to atone for the loss of her child, and she slowly sank into depression. Annette made one disastrous attempt to share her abortion story with a friend at church. But she encountered such condemnation when she did so that she never dared voice it again. She put the thoughts about her lost child to the back of her head and tried to get on with her life. But the guilt and the shame feelings persisted, trapping her inside a grief which could find no legitimate expression, and the constant nagging weight in her chest remained. We're going to leave Annette there for a moment and return to the Bible. Let's read John chapter 8, verses 2 to 11. At dawn, Jesus appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." And again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left. with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they?" Whoops, sorry, gone ahead too far. "Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." A familiar story, but I love this story. It always makes the feminist in me want to cheer. That line, "they made her stand before the group," it just makes your blood boil. But what has this got to do with abortion? Can we look through the two lenses that we're given in the story? What the religious leaders saw and their response, and what Jesus saw and responded to. There's one woman, one set of facts, but two very different responses. So through the lens of the religious leaders, we see a shamed and guilty woman who is without excuse, caught in the act, and deserving condemnation and execution. Seeing her this way, they treat her with contempt and use her as a means of catching Jesus out. She has no value in their eyes. They feel self-righteously justified in her public humiliation. There's truth, she's a sinner, but there's no grace. What do we see through Jesus' eyes? Someone in need of compassion. Verse 6, "But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger." Have you ever asked yourself why he did this? Much ink has been spilt by the commentators. The answer is we don't know. Maybe it was his way of containing his anger. I'm sure his blood was boiling too. But I like to think it was also a way of showing compassion for this woman's humiliation. By averting his eyes, by looking down at the ground, he's refusing to take part in her public shaming. You know, given she's caught in the act, it's even possible she's not properly clothed still, and she's in a public place and made to stand before this group of men. Jesus only finally looks her in the eye when there's nobody else watching. Such compassion. But he also sees someone who is worthy. He patiently waits for everyone to leave, then asks what seems quite an obvious question now. "Where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she says. He's helping her. By asking her this question, he's helping her to acknowledge from her own mouth there is no condemnation from others. You know, shame and unworthiness come when we feel judged by others and when we agree with this assessment inside and condemn ourselves. Jesus was helping her to see herself differently, to see herself as he saw her, a person of value and dignity. She had done something wrong, yes, but it didn't make her wrong. She was not this dirty, shameful woman in his eyes. He was consciously setting out to restore her self-respect. All his actions signaled that she was seen, accepted, and acceptable. She was worthy of respect. She was worthy. She mattered to him. She was therefore worthy. Thirdly, he saw someone needing to know she could be forgiven and start again. So verse 11, "Then neither do I condemn you." The irony of this story, of course, is that Jesus is the one person there without sin who meets the criteria. He remains when everyone else has left. And we can be sure the significance of that was not lost on the woman. She knew whose presence she was in. He could have thrown the first stone. But instead, he chooses to throw her the lifeline of forgiveness. You know, in his grace, it is never Jesus' desire to condemn. He would always rather offer forgiveness. This is what he came for. Remember John 3:17. God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. So the judge of all the world stood in front of this woman and declared her free of condemnation. In such ways, he treated her with extraordinary grace. He saw beyond her sin to the beauty of her person, a heart which yearned for something better, and he called it out of her with compassion and gentleness. Put simply, he loved her. John 3:16. The same love that sent him into the world to die for us. So Jesus' final words to this woman, go now and leave your life of sin, verse 11, perhaps come as a bit of a shock. But it's so important that we see that he also offers her what I like to call the grace of the truth. His compassion for her doesn't mean that he abandons the truth that she's broken the law. Nowhere does he say that what she'd done didn't matter. But at what point does he bring in the truth of her sin? Only when she's confident that she mattered to him. That she had understood that he didn't want to judge her but to free her. Once she knew the condemnation was lifted, she could respond positively to his invitation to change her life, grace and truth. Let's return to Annette. That story actually happened 30 years ago. But a few years ago, Annette came to our centre, where I used to work, and took our post-abortion counselling programme. Not easy. But at last, she'd found somewhere safe and accepting and non-judgmental where she could talk freely of her burden. She worked very hard with the counselling. She learned to acknowledge and safely express her anger, both towards those who had failed and abused her, but also towards herself. She experienced the freedom of accepting responsibility for her part in what had happened and letting go of all her excuses and justifications. And it was very important for her to recognize that the burden of responsibility was not hers alone. Others were also accountable. She had been exploited. But she still struggled with forgiveness. She still felt she had to pay for what she'd done. It was unforgivable. She still felt unworthy. She was still depressed. And as her counselors, this really grieved us. We knew she had a Christian faith, and we knew that final freedom from the past depended on receiving forgiveness, knowing that she was accepted and acceptable. And in a final attempt to communicate to her the grace and compassion of the God she felt so condemned by, my colleague shared this story from John 8 about the woman caught in adultery. And she told it beautifully so that Annette fully understood the grace and mercy that Jesus showed that woman. And she was nodding away, yes, yes, this woman had broken God's law, but Jesus still loved her and could forgive her. And then my colleague said to Annette, now imagine that woman had not been caught in adultery, but had been caught just coming out of an abortion clinic. Would Jesus have had the same response to her? And for, sorry, it makes me cry even now. For the first time, we began to see understanding and hope dawn in her eyes. We could see her thinking, just maybe, even this that she had done could be forgiven too. And Annette did go on to find full forgiveness, and we witnessed a beautiful transformation. Her demeanor changed, her depression lifted. You could see it in her eyes and in her posture. The burden in her chest had gone. One of the most wonderful things for me was that forgiveness gave her the freedom to properly grieve her lost child, to name him, and to give him equal status beside two other children she had subsequently lost through stillbirth. It had always troubled her that because of her shame, she had never been able to honor him publicly before, but now she could, a joy and a privilege to witness. So Annette found her healing, but what about us? What can we learn from this? To return to our question, what should a Christian response be? I think we need to hold equally to grace and truth. The religious leaders had got it right in thinking the woman was guilty. They had a hold of the truth, but they had no grace. And I'm afraid the church has often been like this on the issue of abortion. We've been very clear that abortion is wrong, but we've lacked compassion. However, it is possible, and of course I've seen this as well, to swing the other way, to show so much compassion for women that we actually step outside the boundaries of God's truth and think maybe an abortion is the solution to their problem. But we must be like Jesus, full of grace and truth. It's an uneasy tension, but we do need to respond to abortion in a way that doesn't leave women who have made that choice or are contemplating it feeling judged and condemned. We've lost them if we behave like that. We should speak with sadness, not hate in our voices, with compassionate understanding, not judgmental superiority. I was so encouraged recently when I discovered that the first Christians were just like this. They were compassionate in their practices to all parties, whilst remaining robustly pro-life in their theology. So in first century Rome, abortion practices were actually rife. And it was common also to abandon unwanted newborns on what were known as the exposure walls outside the cities. But the early church, both, we've got good strong evidence for this, both supported women and rescued the babies. And in trying to be the same grace-filled yet truth-based, the modern Christian pregnancy movement therefore stands in a long and honourable tradition. And I find that really wonderful and moving and affirming. However, you might be learning about this Christian crisis pregnancy movement for the first time. So what actually happens at a Christian pregnancy centre? What does practising grace and truth look like? So primarily, centres support women and their families through a pregnancy crisis in a compassionate yet constructive way through counselling and practical support. Pregnancy crisis can be caused by relationship breakdown, initially happily pregnant, but now the relationship's gone wrong, a diagnosis of fetal abnormality, like we said. But the most common thing we see, 90% plus of our clients, it's simply because the pregnancy was unplanned and therefore unwanted. So what do we do? Women and their partners with an unexpected pregnancy are offered a safe counselling space to explore their situation with someone who doesn't judge them. We're warm, welcoming, calm, compassionate. Women arrive anxious, sometimes even panicky. They desperately need space to think, and we give them that time. The session normally takes at least 1.5 hours. I've done 2 2-hour sessions recently, and that's more than they can get anywhere else, and it's free. We use 2 decision-making tools, a head-heart model, which helps them to articulate both what they're thinking about the pregnancy, but also what their heart might be saying, that deeper part of them that includes their values, their beliefs, their conscience. Is there an internal conflict? Part of them wants to be a mum. Another part is really fearful. We commonly see this. We also use a gains and a losses account for their 3 options of parenting, termination, or adoption. Getting them to ask the question of each option, what might I gain by choosing this option, but what might I lose? And not just now, but for the longer term. A lot of women see abortion as the end of it, but encouraging them to think about what might they happen to them after an abortion is very important, although they find that very hard to express. But client feedback consistently demonstrates real strong appreciation from our clients for not being judged and for being given time. You know, it's estimated that 1 in 7 women face reproductive coercion, and we Christians must not be another coercive voice in this arena. We know that God always invites, never coerces. It's common for women to find that everyone else is telling them what to do. Everyone else has an opinion about their pregnancy. Therefore, our counselling is non-directive. We do not have an opinion. I've obviously got my own personal views about what's best for them, but that's not what's going to come out in the counselling room. But that doesn't mean we have to run away from the hard questions or the difficult feelings. You know, ultimately, if offered in love, women appreciate someone who is honest. It encourages them to be honest with themselves. I always remember one client who wept when we were looking at the termination option and also when we considered the adoption option. But she always had this big, broad smile on her face when we talked about continuing the pregnancy. And after a while, I realized she had no idea she was doing this. And so I reflected back this truth to her, this truth about her own heart. And it just gave her the courage to choose the parenting option. And she went on to have a lovely baby boy. So the last thing we'll do is a next steps. Do they need to share this with someone? Is there more information they need to find out? This is a big, huge decision and needs to be taken with all avenues explored. The commonest reason for choosing termination, as I said earlier, in our experience, is fear. Fear of losing something or someone. Helping them to move beyond the dictates of fear and to really listen to their heart is one of our best gifts to them. Those who go ahead with the pregnancy are offered ongoing counselling through the perinatal period, practical support with free loan of baby clothes and equipment, and one-to-one befriending support until their child is 1 year old. In other words, we try to put our money where our mouth is. And those who've had abortions are offered that longer-term counselling which we were doing with Annette. Helps them to process how and why they made the decision, their really complex feelings around it, the anger and grief and guilt and shame and confusion. They're not very often Christians, but we still explore accepting responsibility and finding forgiveness because they are made in God's image, and we know that is the path to healing. On average, it takes 6 months of weekly sessions to complete this 12-step process. Healing takes time. Where do clients come from? The vast majority self-refer from having found us on the internet. But we also, thankfully, now receive referrals from GPs, from community mental health services, and other statutory services for all aspects of the work. The centre I used to work at sees around 400 plus women each year, and it benefits their children and their families as well as the women. So in other words, it's a broader picture. And nearly all our services are free or low cost. I think the work of the centre is best described by sharing another short story with you. This is Ruth and Jonathan's story. Ruth was an overseas student in her early 20s, studying and working to pay her way through her studies. She became pregnant through no fault of her own. She was referred for termination, feeling that she wouldn't cope. But on the day of her appointment, she found she couldn't go through with it. She explained later, "My legs wouldn't take me there." But having taken the day off work, she went and sat in the library, wondering what on earth she was going to do. She couldn't continue in college without working. She couldn't work and study with a baby because of childcare costs. She couldn't even stay in her accommodation with a baby. But displayed at the library was one of our posters, pregnant, worried. That described her exactly, and she came along to see us. When we explained the support we could offer through our befriending service, this was all the encouragement she needed to follow her heart and continue her pregnancy. Gradually, all her unresolved issues fell into place. She got proper medical care set up and the benefits she was entitled to. We accompanied her on all her antenatal visits, shared those really precious first ultrasound scans. And after Jonathan arrived, Ruth was given a place in a mother and baby unit, and we visited with baby clothes and equipment. And after a year, she got a two-bedroomed house, council house, and more practical help was offered, helping her to turn it into a home with furniture and other essentials. And through all this, Ruth's childhood Christian faith was reignited. It was her sense of Christian values in the first place that had prevented her from choosing abortion. And now the experience of pregnancy and motherhood and receiving love and care from other Christians brought her back to her Heavenly Father. In other words, and not wanting to minimize the difficulties of being a single mum, which she was, from the moment Ruth chose life for her baby, God in his grace provided the support and resources that she and Jonathan needed. What I noticed with Ruth was that unlike our post-abortion clients who, as I say, feel so shamed and unworthy, Ruth never lost her self-respect. And what's more, by God's grace, she found real joy and meaning in becoming a mum, even though she had to temporarily abandon her studies. Ruth and Jonathan's story bears out the truth of these words from Deuteronomy 30, verse 19. God is setting before the Israelites a choice. Having given them all his laws for successful living as his redeemed people, he now says, "See, I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Now choose life so that you and your children may live." You see, it's not just Jonathan who received life. Ruth, too, received and discovered life as a result of her choice to do right by her baby and trust God for the consequences. I'd like to close with a word to church leaders. The sad fact is, I know that many of you here will actually never have heard of a Christian pregnancy centre, nor its umbrella organisation, Pregnancy Centres Network. Maybe it's because we're still quite small. Maybe that's due to our deliberate choice to adopt a non-campaigning stance. Our vision is to reach out to abortion-minded women, and a high-vis pro-life branding and rhetoric is not going to help that. But we've also experienced opposition from the media and pro-choice groups. Unfortunately, we're not invisible to them. But it means we're operating within a hostile environment. I mean, this means for the first 30 minutes, at least, when I'm sitting with an unplanned pregnancy client, I'm monitoring for signs that they're a mystery shopper and are secretly recording and filming the session. It's happened more than once. However, we're convinced that we could hugely increase our reach and if we had more support from the church. So if you belong to or lead a church which supports your local pregnancy centre, thank you so much. But sadly, you're a minority. Practical, compassionate responses to abortion don't seem to be on the church's radar. Evangelical church leaders have mostly been silent on this subject. When did you last hear or give a sermon on the value of unborn life and how to respond in a Christ-like manner to the abortion issue? Maybe the politicized, polarized debate in the public square has become so toxic it feels impossible to do it with sensitivity. I get that. But as a result, the fate of hundreds of thousands of babies and their mothers passes year after year without comment, teaching, or apparent concern from the church. Friends, this can't be right. Abortion is a huge issue in our society. It affects millions of women and their partners. And abortion is not only a problem out there, it's here, in this tent, in our churches. Remember that 1 in 3 statistic. And the silence from the church is killing. A colleague ran a survey from our PCN exhibition stand at New Wine in 2021. And she found of 361 respondents, 67% had never heard abortion spoken about at their church, yet 54% were aware of friends outside church affected by abortion, and 21% said it had affected them within the family. Almost 70% were unaware of the Christian crisis pregnancy movement, and not surprisingly, 93% felt there was a need for a local pregnancy centre supported by their church. I wonder if you've ever asked yourself how silence on an issue like this is interpreted by those who affected by it. Women and men assume that if they mention a previous abortion, they will be judged and marginalised, maybe even shunned. The silence shames them, so they say nothing. They are silenced too. One church leader reported abortion. "I've never had anyone say this is bothering them. No one's ever come to me about this." My point. And what about Christians who get pregnant unexpectedly? I've seen several Christian women at our centre who are contemplating abortion in order to avoid the judgment and stigma of a pregnancy outside marriage in the church. One was a pastor's daughter. She just wasn't confident her church community would meet her with grace and understanding and support her in continuing the pregnancy as an unmarried woman. Her pregnancy would just become one long walk of shame. And yet, of course, as Christians, for such women, termination is completely against their own values and beliefs. If they do choose abortion, they can really struggle afterwards. Remember Annette. Friends, we all have our nets sitting in our congregations, silent. So can I urge the church leaders here to consider provide teaching about abortion and how we can respond in a Christ-like way? There is a way to do this with gentleness and sensitivity, and I hope I've demonstrated this today. Let's change the landscape. Wouldn't it be wonderful if church became the place which not only congregations but women across our culture knew was a safe place to find support with these issues? What could you do practically? How about finding out if there's a Christian pregnancy centre near you? Contact PCN for details. If there isn't, might God be calling you to start one? Our centre was started by a group of local churches coming together. PCN can advise about setting up a centre from scratch. Or if that's not possible, consider supporting PCN financially. That would signal to your church that you're committed to a grace and truth-filled response. Those of us working in this field often feel lonely and under attack. This is spiritually contested ground. We need the church behind us. Please pray about these things and consider you might be the answer to your own question, prayer. So here's some existing resources for church leaders: training seminars, stress test, and Christian Medical Fellowship have started a dialogue recently. Come and join the conversation. All the contact details are in the handout. Lastly, just a word for those with personal experience of abortion. If abortion has touched you personally, please know that whatever your involvement, there's healing in the gospel. And please, please get help. Here are some links that you can follow. Sorry, that was a bit quick. Or contact me personally if you prefer to speak confidentially. Don't let the opportunity pass. It won't be easy. It will take courage, and it will be worth it. Let's close with a prayer. Lord Jesus, we are awed by the love and mercy you show to that woman caught in the very act of disobedience and sin. You looked at her and loved her. You're yearning to see her healed and restored, triumphed over your right to judge her. Teach us, dear Lord, to be the same, remembering that we too need your mercy. Help us to be merciful to women who struggle with unplanned pregnancy or have had abortions. We pray that they will know that your people, of all people, will give them a welcome, listen with compassion, and help them to find a way forward. Challenge all of us to find ways to respond to this painful and difficult problem in our culture with grace and truth. Whatever aspect of responding you may call us into, may we proceed with humility and trust, seeking your heart for all that we do. And for those of us who've been involved in abortion, please help us find the courage and humility to get the help we need, trusting in your loving acceptance and forgiveness. And we ask these things for your honor and glory. Amen. Thanks for listening.